reasons and not so reasons are a colloquium. So from the amount of people which are present, I can say that I have not written a famous book. This colloquium is... did I say good? Okay. So it's about this talk will be about the first Wimpy Helos, and I will relate this question to the question how to solve an outstanding problem in cosmological observation theory. So WIMPy stands for weakly interacting massive particles. So yes, I am a big fan of cold dark matter because I think it's cool stuff. And it's really cool stuff, as I will explain. And the work I will present is based on close collaboration with Anne Green, who at the time we started was in Sheffield, but moved now to Nottingham University, Dominic Schwartz, who is a Bielefeld, but will move soon as well, Enzo Francini from Rome, Lydia Fieri, who was in Stockholm and is now in Padua, and Torsten Brinkmann, who is at CISA. So, first, let me motivate what is interesting on the question, why should we bother about the first dark matter halos ever enter the nonlinear regime of gravitational evolution? So in cosmological perturbation theory, which is a linear perturbation theory, people are very much interested in the fluctuations of the energy momentum tensor of any type of matter. Well, in our case, in cold dark matter. For instance, if we take the 0-0 component, and we have the energy density, and we are interested how this energy density fluctuation normalized to the average energy density evolves in time. So this is a typical question in cosmological perturbation theory. And we call this ratio simply the density contours. Okay? It is common, because it's a linear perturbation theory, to work in Fourier space, because in Fourier space, this problem decouples for all co-moving wave numbers k. So k is a co-moving wave number characterizing the density fluctuation, and it's independent of time, it's co-moving. Okay? And then this Fourier coefficient depends also on time, and I took some parameterization of time called redshift, but that is important. Okay? So the folklore says that this density contrast is essentially a product of two functions. Okay? So first, the initial conditions at some initial time. So this is a spectrum of initial density fluctuation, which has been there. And I will not explain where they come from. So basically, they need some mechanism in the universe, in the very early universe, which generates density fluctuations. And I will assume that this mechanism will generate a scaled invariant spectrum of initial perturbations. But I did not discuss where this comes from. The other function is called the transfer function for the density contrast. And basically, the job of the transfer function is to describe the gravitational evolution of my initial data within the linear regime to the redshift where I'm interested to know the density contrast. That's okay. So the problem is, if you ask now what happens on very small scales, for instance, during the time when the universe was dominated by radiation, that is basically the expansion of the universe was driven by all relativistic species in the universe, they were dominant in the energy. You find that this density contrast, due its dependence on this transfer function, which is calculated solely in GR, so this is really a question of GR, has a logarithmic divergence. It grows like the logarithm of this co-moving wave number which characterizes the density fluctuations. And this was recognized for some time as a problem. The first to point out that this is a problem was Birchinger, actually. And then somehow it got forgotten because people started to do numerical simulations. And in numerical simulations, you have to impose numerical cutoffs, right? And this cutoffs regularize basically this logarithm. So the question we were asking is if this really is a fair thing to do, or if there's interesting physics involved with the regularization procedure, which should make this thing here final. So the basic statement is, because of this monotonously increasing contrast when you go to smaller and smaller length scales, larger and larger co-moving wave numbers, is that you get a monotonically increasing power in structure on smaller and smaller scales. So you would never be allowed to cut off anything, because you would cut off those structures which are characterized by the densest contrasts. Okay?
Sorry, just an explanation. Is this because of the growth in the radiation epoch of the matter fluctuation?
Yes, but it persists also the transition from the radiation domination to the matter. Yeah.
You get logarithmic because of that.
Yes. So the whole problem starts sulfurizing the gene during radiation domination of the matter fluctuations. Okay? So the problem with that is, and this is also a very severe problem, that it's basically impossible to consistently solve this problem. Why? From an analytical point of view, there never has been a linear regime. Because at any time, I will find a wave number which makes this contrast so big, this Fourier coefficient so big, that I am not allowed to do linear perturbation theories for all fluctuations. Okay, so there was never a linear regime.
So just another question.
Yeah.
So, but certainly there is a kind of, because there was no dark matter, there was no matter at all in a radiation epoch before there was the decoupling or the freeze out of this species.
There was no matter.
Well, before it went through the mass thresholds and all these things. So basically everything you can think of was radiation.
Yes. But at some stage, yeah. That becomes part of the kinetic decoupling, which I will explain the history of that. But at the end of the day, you will have, after kinetic decoupling, this problem, and you're still in the linear regime for a long time.
Sure.
So, and that's just the problem.
Right. So you could arrange things so that the dark matter was produced sufficiently later on, there was never in the linear regime.
Well, it depends. Let me come to it. It depends if the dark matter was still a kind of wind, that is a particle which was once in contact with a local zone of heat mass, you still would get this problem. So the question we can ask is, what is missing here in this picture? Well, this question is related with another question. That is, if I inspect this transfer function, and I told you it's basically calculated using general relativity, the only input I have from the particle theory underlying my Wilm candidate is its equation of state, pressureless matter. There's no dependence at all on the interaction theory of this particle. And that's a bit depressing, because what would be nice is if we would observe structures today, evolve them back in time, and somehow could draw some conclusions from this evolving back in time about the interaction theory. But there is no chance, because this transfer function does not know anything of the interactions. Okay, and we will see that both questions are related. So this was a theoretical motivation. Let me come to the experimental motivation. And there are two types of experiments we should consider here. One is numerical experiments, and the other is real experiments, basically. Why this problem is serious for them? Well, first of all, current state-of-the-art numerical simulations, until recently, had a cutoff scale in mass, I will explain what that is, of 10 to the 6 solar masses. That means every dot of dark matter you see in the simulations has a mass of 10 to the 6 solar masses. That means you cannot resolve any physics which is characterized by a mass scale below this 10 to the 6 solar masses. Okay? And this turned out to be a problem, as Ben Moore showed in a very nice work, because the question was, should we care about this resolution limit or not? And they said, well, at least if I increase the resolution of my simulation, I find more and more substructure entering in my results. So my simulation is not convergent with respect of the number of substructures when I increase the resolution. Okay. But the substructures are the interesting objects to look for. Like in a lot of dark matter searches, direct and indirect, we are sensitive on substructures. not on these large scale structures which are characterized by these masses. So the question is, can we really trust the singularity? It's obvious, that's not the question, but how can we draw conclusions about structure formation on small scales which are sensitive for direct and indirect detection experiments? Well, one real experiment one could look in is the following. So despite the fact that dark matter particles have chemically decoupled, I will explain what that is on the next slide, it is clear that the overdensities in the substructures we want to describe is big enough to initiate, again, annihilation processes of dark matter particles in all type of other standard particles. And let's say we focus on gamma rays. Then we can ask, basically, what is the flux density we would get from these annihilation processes here down on Earth? And basically, that can be split up in two contributions. In a diffuse flux, plus a line contribution, right? So the line contribution comes from direct annihilation precisely into two gammas, two photons, right? And this line contribution is directly proportional to the density contrast squared. That's why we should be interested in this object here. Yeah? The diffuse flux actually is as well proportional to the density contrast squared. But there is involved a redshift interval over the history during which these annihilation processes could have appeared. So it's a bit more complicated. But here, for the line contribution, which is kind of a very exciting feature in the photon spectrum, we have this direct proportionality. Okay? Also, I have to admit that the line contribution is something which is difficult to detect because of finite detector resolution. So I hope I have motivated that one should not only speak about large-scale structure formation, but think about structure formation on scales that are much, much smaller than these scales. Boom. Now I have to apologize. Okay, I will apologize first of all to all particle theorists. Okay? When we did this calculation first, we had a specific candidate in mind, which was the BINO, and we supposed BINO to be the lightest supersymmetric particle in the minimum supersymmetric extension of the time. And the calculation is very technical, okay? But the point is that the basic argument, line of argument, can be done back on the envelope when I use the following model for wind. So for this colloquium, I got rid of all particle physics. But in the real world, of course, we include it, yeah? So what is a wind here? Apologize again to the particle. What is a wind? So that wind stands for weakly interacting massive particles. Weak is because we want these particles to annihilate with a weak scale in order to get the right relic abundance, which is measured, if you believe in the concordance model, by measuring the temperature and anisotropies or the cosmic microwave background. And we want it to be massive in order to be non-relativistic at the time when structure formation becomes efficient. Now, three assumptions I will make, and only one of them is essential. The other two assumptions are just to keep the colloquium on a level somebody not so much interested in cosmology can follow. So what are the assumptions? First, I assume, and this is not a relevant assumption, that there existed no wind anti-wind asymmetry. In concrete, that means when I will expand a non-equilibrium theory, which I will do later on, around an equilibrium theory, I will forget about the chemical potential of the waves. That's all I mean. Okay? And this is not necessary. That's just to keep things simple. Second assumption I will do, and this is a relevant assumption, that when the temperature of the universe was much, much higher than the mass of the wind, yeah, these particles have been in local thermal equilibrium. And this is a big assumption, which is true for this class of WIMPs, but it's unfortunately not true for another very important class of dark matter particles, and that are axions. Axions have the problem that their interaction scale are suppressed by the Patrick Wimp scale, and basically the universe at any time for them was transparent. Yeah? So they are essentially non-equilibrium phenomena, depending on their production. Those particles we cannot treat here, which is a pity, right? But not with this. And that's a real constraint. What we can treat are particles like the Leibniz photosymmetric particle or the Leibniz Kaluza-Klein particle in models with extra dimensions, like the first excitation of the photon or something like that, in these models. Yeah, again, I apologize. I will assume that the scale for the cat cross section is roughly a picobar. And it's basically given by Fermi's constant times the mass squared of the charged H bosons of the standard model. And here we have the mass of the neutral H boson. But that's basically a combination which adds up if I put in a typical mass here, let's say 100 GeV from a wind candidate, which adds up to a picobar, which is a typical scale for a weak decay effect in power. Okay? So basically, you could view this as a low energy limit of heavy neutrino leptons if you want. As I said, the original calculations were done really taking care of the MSSM, but this is enough for our argument. Actually, we can even reproduce the case of a beam, as we will see. Now, why is particle theory important for structure formation? A lot of people would claim it isn't. Why? Because as we will see, basically, particle theory ended after the first millisecond. And then these particles, the dark matter particles, are only free streaming on geodesics of your given space-time. Let's say Friedman models and Walker. Yeah? The first structures go nonlinear 40 million years later. So you might think, OK, I have a big span between the first millisecond and 40 million years. Particle theory shouldn't be important. And I will try to prove that this statement is wrong. The first thing these particles do is chemical decoupling. What is it? So we begin, as Zhao pointed out, with a universe which basically consisted, in some sense, only of one type of particle, relativistic particles. They were in chemical equilibrium and in kinetic. Chemical equilibrium at that stage meant that I even had fulfillment of detailed balance. That is, whenever, let's say, two standard model particles annihilated dark matter particles, the rate of this annihilation was equal to the rate of dark matter annihilations into two standard model particles. So both rates were equal. That's called detailed balance. Unfortunately, the temperature of the universe is dropping due to the redshift because the universe expands. Now, at some stage, the kinetic energy of the standard model particle, which are in local thermal equilibrium, is not enough to produce dark matter particles any longer. That's the story. Yeah? Dark matter particles can still annihilate in standard model particles due to their huge rest mass. And this is a very dangerous time for dark matter particles because their total number gets reduced. The total number of the universe gets reduced by this process. OK, we can ask, does this process stop at some temperature? And the answer is yes. You can answer this question either in solving a kinetic theory or making a rule of thumb estimation. And the rule of thumb is I compare the annihilation rate with the Hubble rate. Hubble rate describes the expanding of the universe. So I have two rates. And the picture you would have in mind, because you saw it really the kinetic theory, but the picture you have basically two dark matter particles kind of close to each other in interaction range, start to feed each other, one to annihilate, and then the universe expands again and brings them away so that they apply to each other. If you do that, you find that the ratio of the mass of the dark matter particle over the chemical decoupling temperature is this famous quote. It's quoted in the literature 25, I think it's 23, plus logarithm, which depends on the mass of the particle, its effective degrees of freedom, its relic abundance, and some stuff which describe the relativistic degrees of freedom, which constitutes the entropy at that time. So now you can ask, where is particle theory? I see no dependence on annihilation cross-section. Indeed, I even did not introduce it. That is because we have the big advantage that we know what we can take the point of view, well, that's measured. And if it's measured, I can annihilate. Oh, no, I shouldn't say annihilate. What can I do? I can get rid of the dependence in this chemical decoupling X of the annihilation processes, of the interactions. I can just get rid of it. So here is no particle information where it belongs. It's just the mass of the particle, right? Well, however, after chemical decoupling, so we have now basically two distinct species. We have these relativistic particles, basically the light standard nanoparticles, and we have this dark matter particle, and they are chemically distinct, yeah? But they are still in kinetic equilibrium with each other. And that's because elastic scattering processes proceed with high frequency. Eventually, the temperature drops down far enough. We again use our rule of thumb, asking one, when is the elastic scattering rate equal to the Hubble rate? More fair question to ask is, what is the relaxation time within the dark matter particles proportional, let's say similar to the Hubble time? And the relaxation time is the time needed in order to maintain or bring back dark matter particles which were out of equilibrium back to the vector equilibrium. Well, you do the calculation, let's say, from Majorana fermions, and it turns out that for a particle which has mass of 100 GeV, this temperature is 34 MeV. So there are two orders of magnitude in between chemical decoupling and kinetic decoupling. And this basically concludes the chemical and the thermal history of these particles. What we see, could have seen if I'd written it more clever, is that this ratio really depends on the relaxation time, which is inverse proportional to the elastic scattering. So here we kept the information. There is no experiment which can tell us something about the kinetic decoupling temperature. So really, here we have to keep part of it. The question is, and this is now the idea, does this information about particle theory somehow enters the structure formation or not? That's the question. So here we kept it. Well, and I wanted to Andre a favor because he was caring quite recently a lot about viscosity, so I thought we can put it in the language of viscosities that he can digest better for lunch today. So cosmologists like to think of the universe, at least the early universe, to consist of fluids. Yeah, and this is not naive. This has a justification. No? The advantage of this description is that a lot of processes which are super difficult when you focus on the microscopic level turn out to add up to processes you can really get an imagination on the macroscopic scale. So you're basically looking for collective effects such as viscosities. They have a complicated macroscopic gradient, but the physics on a macroscopic scale is quite simple. The first thing to get an idea then is to study hydrodynamics. And our wishful thinking is that somehow this information about particle interactions survives until structure formation becomes sufficient. That is the reason why we are interested in studying hydrodynamics ultimately around this temperature of kinetic decoupling, 30 degrees. Okay. But let's start from the beginning. Let's tell the story I told before again in the hyperdynamics. So we start at temperatures much above the chemical temperature when every particle was relativistic. At that stage, the hydrodynamical description consists of two Lorentz tensors. One is the current density and one is the energy momentum tensor. Okay? And basically, both of them are given by the velocity field, U, that's really a field now. Okay? And some other structure, H, I will introduce later after I have defined the pressure. And then we have here the number density of our particles in this fluid, the energy density, and the pressure. The point with pressure is, and this is geometrically now very important, this H plays a leading role in calculating non-equilibrium stuff here for cold stuff. So this H now is what? Whenever I want to define a pressure, I need an area perpendicular to the current density in order to define against which area does this pressure act, actually. And this H is a projection operator in the direction perpendicular to my adiabatic current density. Okay? Well, that's very nice. We will keep this meaning in mind because it will give us nice interpretation here below. At temperatures between chemical and kinetic decoupling, the radiation fluid and the CDM fluid are apparent as two distinct fluids. They are chemically distinct. But still, due to the tight coupling between both fluids, which, as we saw before, came because of elastic scattering processes, they are still in kinetic equilibrium. And that just doubles the number of Lorentz factors I have. Okay? For each fluid, I have one. Both are in perfect equilibrium, the kinetic equilibrium, but I can distinguish them chemically. Okay? Now comes the exciting question. What happens around kinetic decoupling? Well, around kinetic decoupling, my Kohlak-Meller fluid is still close to Lorentz equilibrium. It's almost perfect, but only almost. And the deviations I can encode because of the almost, because I'm doing a linear perturbation theory, in new tensor structures appearing here for the current density and for the energy momentum. Now, we can follow Landau Lipschitz, for instance, and say, I will have a J1 and I will have a T1. Or we can follow Eckhart and Weinberg and say, no, that's not a good idea. Even if it was Weinberg to say that, but even if I want to keep this J as my adiabatic current density. So make this to zero and put all non-equilibrium effects into this T1. It's an ambiguity, but I would like to choose this way because then I always have a direction in space-time which characterizes equilibrium physics. Because it turns out, if I proceed this way, these tensors here, which appear in this T1, are all perpendicular to the adiabatic current. So basically, I can identify all non-equilibrium processes by just looking what's perpendicular to the equilibrium current. So this is a very common thing. So now coming to Andre a little bit. In the hydrodynamical picture, there are two processes which are important. Bulk viscosity and shear viscosity. The third one is heat conduction, but heat conduction for cool stuff is very important. So it's a subheating process. We calculated it, but let's forget about that. Yeah? So what is bulk viscosity then in this picture? So here's a Lorentz tensor describing bulk viscosity. I appear the adiabatic current density. And then locally, I have a volume expansion. Yeah. So I have a non-vanishing four divergence of the velocity field, and this translates in the volume expansion. And the volume expansion is projected to the directions perpendicular to this adiabatic current density. This is this geometrical interpretation, which gives us nice intuitions. And basically, we can imagine if we have an energy density fluctuation, and locally, the volume starts to expand, the energy density fluctuations, because it's proportional to the volume, decreases. So that's some idea we will keep in mind. And I will show that's precisely the effect of these coefficients, these viscosities. The other viscosity is really related to the bending of the adiabatic current density, or the velocity fields, in the direction perpendicular to the adiabatic current density. There is no source for a volume expansion, it's really the bending, which is described by four gradients of the velocity. Now, we have, I hope, a physical picture of what are the macroscopic effects which come up in this dark matter. The problem is that we don't know the strengths. The strengths of these effects are encoded in these two coefficients. And the game is now we have to calculate them somehow. The nice thing is this introducing the hydrodynamical picture is that it's quite easy to calculate them because I can come up with a kinetic description which is as close as possible to this hydrodynamical description and just read then the coefficients off by comparing the Lorentz structures. Now, the kinetic description is more sensitive, is more fundamental because it knows most of the interactions of the theory of the dark matter. Okay, just to sketch how this works. Now try to learn as much as possible from this hydrodynamical description to make life easier. So first of all, I'm interested at temperatures about kinetic decoupling, and I have a phase space distribution of dark matter particles. So this is the central object in kinetics. Now, since I'm almost at equilibrium, I can try to expand the phase space distribution around this equilibrium value. Okay? The equilibrium value, again, has a zero, but the non-equilibrium stuff has this F1. And I have to assume and I have to check that this F1 is much smaller than F0, because otherwise the modifications wouldn't be as easy. Okay? And then, basically, the statement is from studying the collision, Boltzmann collision, that the total change of my equilibrium distribution in the direction of the momentum of a particle is not zero, but it's changed. And this change is generated by the linearized collision, which depends now linearly, it's a linear functional of this F1. All I have to do is I know this function. I can invert it and calculate F1 because I can calculate all the derivatives here, can invert this functional, and I get F1. If I have F1, I have the full phase space distribution. If I have the full phase space distribution, I can calculate all the observables I wish in kinetic theory. Okay. Now, a funny thing is it turns out that basically F1 is of the following form. So this is a scalar, here's a vector, and here appears this n. And this n is again a vector, now a vector field, which is perpendicular to my velocity. So I had to introduce something similar in the kinetic theory, which I had already in the hyperbolic. Yeah, and then I have a two form here, and here is my h, which I introduced before, it's the same h. I calculate my observables with this F1. Okay? And I find indeed the current density is zero, the modification of the current density. I only have adiabatic. And the energy momentum tensor, I get this result. Okay? And this result I have to compare with my hyperdynamic description, can just read off the equations. Now, the funny thing is, of course, this is not true in general. In general, I will get lower structures which are forbidden by geometrical arguments. The point is that we saw in the hydrodynamical picture that there is an ambiguity where to distribute between those two Lorentz structures, how to distribute the non-equilibrium effects. And I had to choose, I had to make a choice. And this choice is something like a thermodynamic gauge fix. Now, if I calculate the kinetic theory naively, yeah, and this was also pointed out by Weinberg, if I do that naively, then I might end up with something I cannot compare with the hydrodynamic description simply because I have not recognized that the choice I made in the hydrodynamic picture amounts to a redefinition of what I call temperature and of what I call number density. Okay? So I have to formulate both theories in the same values. And then I can read off my viscosities just by comparing. Here it is, basically. Forget about this 5 over 3. It's not important. For cosmologists, this is good 1 here. So I have here the energy density, the average energy density of cold dark matter particles. I have here the sound speed of dark matter squared. It's roughly T over N. Okay? And that's the relaxation time, which is inverse proportional to the elastic skin angle. So, that's interesting. This kinetic decoupling keeps track of the information of what type the interaction of my particles are. What is the effect now on the central object I introduced in the second slide? Namely, on the density converse. This is ultimately what you want to see. Does this density converse know something about particles here at the end of the day? Yes or no, and if yes, would that be cosmologically relevant or not? Well, what is the effect of my viscosities here is the following. Suppose I have a CDN plot here, yeah, and compared to the average surrounding here, this amounts to energy density fluctuation with a contrast delta. Now, I have this viscous coupling generated by the coefficients of bulk and shear viscosity to the local heat mass. Okay? And as I will show, this viscous coupling basically decreases my density contrast. Okay? And the amount of non-equilibrium physics, which is basically decreased, is transferred to the heat vest, and the heat vest has no memory. It forgets about it immediately. Now, if you do this analysis, there are a lot of approaches. So you can derive it from kinetic theory, or you do linearized Navier-Stokes equation. You get two equations, one evolution equation first order for the energy density, the other for velocity, and combine them. What you end up, and I only show you the leading terms, because the other terms were discussed quite recently. And we can discuss about them by Matthias Salayan and Blum. It's the following: you end up with an oscillator equation. And this damp oscillator and the time-dependent damping is generated by the viscosity coefficients. Wow. So it's clear, if I solve this equation, the density contrast will end with a null sum in the particle interactions as encoded in the viscosity coefficients. And you can solve this equation, and you get an exponential damping. And the scale for this damping, and that's only for the cosmologist, is very, very tiny. It's of the order of 0.4 parsec per parsec. In terms of masses, it's something like 10 to minus 10 solar masses. And this means that in order to survive the kinetic decoupling process, you have only to consider energy density perturbations, which comprise an amount of energy which is equivalent to 10 to minus 10 solar masses. Everything else is erased by the process of kinetic decoupling. Now, what was the numerical resolution limit? We quoted 10 to the plus 6 solar masses. So we have 16 orders of magnitude difference. I will show this will improve a little bit when I consider free screening. But at the end of the day, it's true that there's a difference between what the numerical cutoff is and what the real cutoff of nature is, of 12 orders of magnitude in numerical simulations. My statement is not that this would affect large-scale structure simulations or the physics of large scales, but it certainly does affect small-scale structure. Okay, now, the density contrasts which have survived this horrible process of kinetic decoupling generated by viscous processes, can we be sure to end up in the nonlinear regime and build galaxies, clusters of galaxies, and so on and so forth? No, they can't. Because after kinetic decoupling, they start a regime which is called the free-streaming regime. And this free-streaming regime can be described mathematically by solving the collision-less Boltzmann equation. And you can ask, you could have done that right from the beginning. Why did you care about kinetic decoupling? Because you will show that this process is much stronger, does modify my gravitational expectation much more than the other process. But I have to solve it with appropriate initial conditions. And those I have to know, and I have calculated. Now, so the geodesic motion does what? If I have overdensity and my particles find a geodesic, they can propagate from an overdense region to an underdense region, thereby equilibrating. This is the picture, basically, these density contrasts. I can solve this equation and understand why free streaming is called collision-less damping, because I get the damping of the same analytical shape. Forget about the spread factor, this is the sort of thing. I get an exponential, damping exponential, just with a different scale, but it looks really like collision damping. It's just the scale is, and that's again only for cosmology, just one per parsec for the scale, and this translates into 10 to the minus 6. So this is something like the Eros mass, or like the mass mass, as better scale. This is quite something. It's small for large scale structure formation, but yeah, it's something. Now, where are we? Just to summarize. We see that the folklore was wrong because it didn't neglect particle interactions. That is, gravitational GR alone will give you an ill-defined answer on structural behavior. You have to include particle interactions. And particle interactions will give rise to a new factor here, the damping factor, which is basically generated by this process of kinetic decoupling. The whole factor is here. There's a free spinning scale and a kinetic decoupling scale. And this damping factor damps away my divergence here. So, and it's a physical, cutoff I get and the spectrum of the density contrast. Yeah? Okay, and I said the damping scale from kinetic decoupling was roughly 10 to the minus 10 solar masses, and this is roughly 1% of the Hubble round radius at kinetic decoupling. So all fluctuations which are characterized by being smaller than 1% of the Hubble radius at kinetic decoupling are washed out. And for free streaming, I end up with 10 to the minus 6 solar masses.
Here's the question. Wouldn't you get from nonlinearity lines in polar domes, which would be much, and it could basically bring the spectrum up from nonlinear processes?
This is all contrasts you can come up, baryons, radiation, so everything is linear. We check that. Sure.
So the nonlinearity later on.
Our point is to predict consistent initial conditions for the nonlinear regime.
Okay, you don't care about me.
Yes,
not
yet.
This is not what you observe nowadays.
No, I come to that what you observe. It's because there are people who use dedicated supercomputers and run them with these initial conditions and check what is the outcome of that. And this is what really clever guys do. I can do that and I will show you. The only picture. Hey, it's not really simple. It's the, yeah, it's the only picture.
Excuse me, but the cutoff is set by the screen.
Yeah. Except for the free stream, but in order to solve free streaming, you get only the right amount of the free streaming scale if you solve the free streaming equation with the correct initial conditions. And the correct initial conditions for free streaming were set by the process of kinetic decoupling. So because I know that a lot of people here like baryons and think they are important, so let's just human thinking. So for those guys, I have included. So because a lot of people claim, what about variance? If you include variance for this process, that was just following from the discussion, from short discussion we had with Joao just now, is that basically baryonic density contrasts are small in the regime you consider. The reason is that at a redshift bigger than a million or so, baryons are tightly coupled to the radiation fluid. Every fluctuation, baryons are wiped out. And that can be strictly proved by solid kinetic theory. Before recombination, unfortunately, baryon contrast starts to grow on certain scales. And the point is that the baryonic density contrast is still much smaller than the dark matter density contrast. So I'm still on the safe side. But after decoupling of baryons from photon, of course, the baryons start to grow quite fast. So between a redshift of 1,000 and a redshift of 150, I'm still on the safe side. So I can go down to a redshift of 150 if I consider wave numbers which are larger than 1,000 per megaparsec. But we saw the scales we are interested in are 4 or 5 orders larger than these scales. So in that sense, we are safe from baryonic impurities. At the end of the day, one has to consider that. Just to stress this, because I was a bit pessimistic about the baryons. If you forget about the baryons at all, you will find a density contrast which is twice as high as when you include them. Okay, so you need to consider baryons, and we did that. We even considered the transition not only from radiation to matter domination, but also from matter domination to dark energy domination. Now comes the answer, the thing we want to give somebody who does numerical simulations, and they did it. And we like to have a power spectrum. So basically, the power spectrum is yeah, that's nice. So the simulations were done with something which was called the set box, the ratchet box. So basically, what they asked us for is not that delta, which we calculated, just to remind you, considered of three factors, the transfer function, which was calculated using GR, a damping factor, which was calculated using non-equilibrium dynamics based on the quantum field theory, underlying dark matter kinetics at some initial step. And what they like to put in is something which is a dimensional power spectrum, which is just some normalization here. So this is how the power spectrum of the Schillingian noise is related to the object we discussed all the time. And here is the answer. So basically focus on the picture, please, because the rest is more for people who are interested. So we normalize the power spectrum to the W fluctuations as, it's normalized to W, basically. And it looks as follows. So you indeed have that structure formations on smaller and smaller scales get more and more important. So it's monotonously increasing. If you forget about the damping we just calculated, it will go on increasing. But due to the non-equilibrium process we discussed, we have a quite sharp, actually, cutoff in this spectrum. This regularizes the spectrum in the linear regime. We are here at a redshift of 300 or so. And this cutoff scatters around a k of 1 per parsec, basically for the models I have not discussed, basically for the wind kinetics, it's around 1 per parsec, it's a fair save. It will be different for AGP, but for light explosive night bodies. So, now, close to this cutoff is a maximum of this power spectrum. The maximum of this power spectrum characterizes those fluctuations which enter the nonlinear regime first. Okay, those are the densest objects ever to enter the nonlinear regime. And they would be, if they would survive until today, the most promising to look for detection experiments because their density contrast is highest in the hierarchical picture structure. Okay, so how do the typical first halos look like? They go nonlinear at around a redshift of 60 plus minus 10, that's roughly 40 million years in the concordance model. The mass of these objects is roughly the mass of planet-like mass. And the physical size is roughly 0.02 parsecs. That's quite huge for such a small mass because this is precisely the size scale of our solar system. Okay, so we have a mass of planet mass, basically, distributed all over our solar system. And these are the densest objects in this region. And the density contrast is would then be at the end of the day of the order 10 to the 6, that is roughly comparable to what you have in the galactic disk in as a density contrast. And this opens up this issue of survival for abilities I don't have to comment on. So yeah, this is what you roughly see. Nonlinearity starts at a scale of 1 per parsec at around redshift of 60. If you switch off a non-equilibrium physics, you never would have linear regime. Yeah, you always would end up in a non-equilibrium. Okay, now let me show you. I have to show rare fluctuations. So far I have studied only typical fluctuations. But of course, assume I know the distribution of these fluctuations. And there are some arguments. You know, assume they are normally distributed. That's just a game. Just a game, okay? And you take an N sigma fluctuation. Let's take N equals 3. You would find that the typical density contrast for N equals 3 is roughly 10 times the density contrast you find in the disk on average. And this gives quite some hope that they survive. Actually, numerical studies, which have now been performed as analytical studies by Anne Green and by Ben Moore and by other groups, showed that they have, strange enough, they have a survival probability. Now, Ben Moore did a great thing. And he put this spectrum in his ZBox. This is a dedicated supercomputer which was built only to solve structure functions. It's a really cool thing. Something we never had a PIO. Okay, so no, I mean, because we are not doing American stuff. Oh, that's nice quality. yeah, the picture is nicer actually on the. Of course, you see a lot of dark stuff, but that was not what you should see. so, okay, I have to explain this. Never mind. I mean, it's just. Okay. So, this is a typical large scale structure simulation. He published in Nature 2005 using our initial conditions. And the size of this box here is roughly 3 kilopascals. Okay. And then he did a zoom 2 times of a factor of 100, roughly. Yeah. And then he, and this zoom was not a, like an image trick, it was really a calculation based on multi-scale analyzers invented by Virchow. So it's really a calculation. Yeah? And it's, I only say it's the first step, I don't say that's the final answer. But what he finds then, at highest resolution, he ends up as clumps in his numerical simulation at a redshift of 26. So we stopped at 60. Yeah? At a redshift of 26, which have precisely the characteristics we predicted. More scientifically, and this is the last thing I show you, this is basically science, if he does. The serious stuff, if you go away from the pictures, which are nice, the following. He has here the number density of substructure of mass m, and he has a derivative of that with respect to the masses. So what we see here is m to the minus 1 is a power law for this mass function you get from large scale structure simulations. And it amazingly well fits our calculation at large scales. But then you have a turn over here around 10 to the minus 6 solar masses. At a redshift of 26. So basically, the effect we calculate, this is his claim, I cannot do these simulations, is that this effect persists until a redshift of 26. And there's good reason to believe that it persists until today. Yeah, and running out of time. Stop.
For technical education, I mean, we don't have a supercomputer, but some of our colleagues will make a supercomputer, a quantum computer.
I doubt that my time at PI would be long enough. No, I think the right answer would have been that we have super brains. That's. Yeah.
So how would you modify your formulas to deal with like the axiom case?
But we are thinking about it, so unfortunately watching as well. For the accents, yeah, it's a good question. The problem is the accent is that you get a nonlinear process equation for the scalar. That's the problem. That's the first problem. The second problem is you cannot, this is essentially non-equilibrium. You cannot expand it around. You can move, there's no perturbation theory in non-equilibrium dynamics available for that type of stuff. What you could do is, you could solve the basic, the most important generation, the production of x. So you could solve for that. Extract from that the phase space function. And use this as an input to the free streaming. Mm. And then it actually.
So basically solve the collisionless. Boltzmann, but with that input.
That would be an idea. So basically, what Ben Mier did in his simulation, so this curve here, the red circles, are for accents. He basically wanted to show there is no turnover so far, but just because nobody has calculated. But it will be very different. A Colvin cutoff calculated a few years ago, and a calculation I think one should redo, especially because Witten wrote also a recent paper about the importance of accents for string theory, which really we do this to put cosmological bounds. He calculated something like the average mass of an axiom mini cluster, he called it. Yeah? And these masses are of the order 10 to the minus 12. So that shows you Like in the best of all worlds, if we could measure these small substructures, if they would be really persistent and not be disrupted further, yeah, you have a big difference. 6 orders of magnitude between the axions and the lightest cosmic particle for the typical mass of substructures in the universe. But I think that would be my first. There's a lot of issues here, too. So Costas told me that you really have to bother about isochronical perturbations and all the garbage axioms would certainly generate. So it's not good, but it should be done, it must be done.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you've heard about these ideas, astronomers like of measuring reionization bubbles between 2 and 1 centimeter lines.
No, unfortunately.
Well, apparently you should be able to actually find that. You should actually be able to measure up to that shift. It could actually be 40 or something. What the structure was like in the universe.
Really? Yeah. That would be annoying. I didn't know that. Okay, we should talk about it. Would be right. So my at the moment, because I'm on the theoretical side, I'm in contact with people from imaging and class. And our point was that if you don't know where to look really precisely on the sky, the just for the audience to appreciate what problems the experimentalists encounter. The densest structures of cold dark matter, when they annihilate, give you an amount of photons we could collect on planet Earth, which is equivalent to putting a candle on Pluto and measuring the photons coming from Pluto. Just to give you how clever these guys are that they can measure anything at all. Yeah? So what we do is we have an idea where to look for, and this is a haze, which was pointed out by Pink Bike. Recently. That's towards the galactic center, 20 degrees in the direction of the south and north pole. You have an excess of synchrotron, of light emission, which could be in concordance with synchrotron emissions from electron positrons produced during dark matter accumulation. So we are looking in that a little bit because that seems.
So the thing I mentioned is more about exactly at some point in the universe we are going to, it's going to be homogeneous.
Yeah.
And it's going to give you a handle on the structure.
No,
so it's slightly different. I mean, basically.
Yeah, no, that would be very interesting. Maybe because
so basically that bit of the spectrum when you be measuring as a function of redshift as well.
Yeah, that would be great. That's a great idea. Let's discuss about it. That's really great. Well, I didn't know that.
You made a side remark about the survival probabilities of the first halos at the very preliminary regime. So
much do you
actually know about that?
Okay. No, since we are all friends here, honestly, I would say I don't know anything. Because there are some, there are some first, it doesn't horrible non-trivial, but they evolve these things. There is a reason why Ben Moore had to stop at a redshift of 26, right? It was the simulation. So there are some analytical approximations and numerical approximations which show that most of these structures could survive. The naive expectation is they should have a survival probability because, especially for these N sigma fluctuations, the density contrast could be as high as 10 times of the average density contrast of the galactic disk. But you're absolutely right, that has to be investigated much, much more carefully than has been done right now. And people are aware of that. It's just we don't know right now. It's still a young field.
I was just going to comment on that. There are two completely different problems. So these things should survive, or there's no argument why they wouldn't survive in dark matter halos that didn't have stars in them. And then there's the completely separate issue of what happens when you put them in the dense stellar field where all of a sudden the potential is very different on the subparsec scale. So that is a complicated question. But if you saw, for instance, a small halo with a galaxy, that these things should survive and that there's no reason for them to get disrupted relative to the larger substructure.
I mean, that's a very good point. I mean, these halos, for instance, they pass, for instance, through the solar system, can estimate. Every 10,000 years, the contact with the solar system is about 40 years. But we might ask, what happens to such a halo if it hits a compact star? And this problem was also addressed by Anne Green. She will be here, by the way. I should have announced it in 2 weeks and report about that work in much more technical detail. I mean, I was just giving like basic physical picture behind it. She will give a much more technical thought, actually. And I think she will talk about that as well. They did numerical simulations and analytical estimates, and they turned out to be quite in concordance, actually. And they say even depends on impact parameter studies you have to do and these things, but they have a survival. They have good survival. Mm-hmm. But I agree, yeah, that's separate issues. That's right.
Any other questions or comments? No, I think that's it.